Today's Dead Idea, Reanimated Corpses. And this is part two. And that's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm BT Newberg, but you can call me Brandon. With me again are my co-hosts for the day, Nick.
Howdy.
And Anna.
But you can call me Anna.
All right. I will call you Anna. Anna?
Well, thank you.
Yes. Not Santa Anna, but just Anna is fine.
I'll take Santa.
Yeah. All right. So thanks, everybody, for being with us for our second episode. Like I said, this is going to be a storytelling episode, and this is going to be a story of two friends, two buds, two traveling companions who have a falling out, and then a magical duel, and one of them ends up going kind of crazy. And one of them is, of course, a reanimated corpse.
Oh, so this is Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Almost. Yeah. No, so, yeah. Well,
Harry Potter's reanimated corpse.
Hey, let's not. I don't want to get in any copyright battles with J.K. Rowling here. So let's just cool it, guys. Okay.
That's it.
Okay. All right. So just a little bit before we get started, just a few caveats. First of all, we're telling these stories. It's about Gosala and his traveling companion Mahavira. Now Gosala is the founder of this dead religion, Ajivika, but Mahavira is the great teacher of a living religion, Jainism, and which, of course, there are plenty of followers still around today. Very thriving religion in India. So, you know, in
1,252,105 in 1931.
Ooh, thank you. Very nice.
Dang.
So we don't mean any insult or offense to anybody. We're going to have some fun with these stories. And hopefully we're going to learn something in the process and, we're going to have fun, but we're going to do it respectfully as well. And, you know, just let's work with us, everybody. Work with us here. Come on. Okay. All right. So we're actually working with some primary sources today. So, that's where we're getting this from. But that's an interesting aspect of what's going to color everything we talk about today, because the Ajivikas, none of their texts survive today. We don't have anything that they themselves wrote. We don't get their voice. We don't get their direct exposition of their beliefs or anything. Everything that we have comes through the texts of rival sects, namely Buddhist texts and Jain texts, which were competing religions at the time. That adds something to the way that you have to read this and the way that you have to listen to this. You have to assume that this is not necessarily kind of like portraying a perfectly accurate kind of thing. You know, it could be a little skewed, could be a little biased, could be a lot biased. Okay. So the stories we're talking about today actually come from a text called the Bhagavati Sutra, which is a Jain text from around the 3rd to the 4th century BCE, scholars estimate, which is about 1 to 2 centuries after the events that are described or supposedly described. I tried hard to find the text itself, but I could only find it in the Prakrit, the language in which it was written. So given that I haven't devoted my life to learning ancient languages, unfortunately, to get it in English, I do have to quote from the summary of it from a scholar named Basham. So I'll be quoting from Basham here. But he does a fairly good job of bringing it to life. And an interesting note, we were talking about how things can be a little biased. Well, Basham says that this text essentially makes Gosala into a Sancho Panza. Sancho Panza, which I think is from Don Quixote,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
he's little the sidekick of Don Quixote. So basically, he's saying Gosala is kind of like the sidekick for Mahavira, the sort of comic relief almost for Mahavira here.
Although Quixote is delusional.
I know.
Yeah, Sancho Panza is kind of the one who gets everything right.
song.
Add some layers of complexity.
Yeah,
here.
Some layers of complexity there. Yeah, so I wondered about that. I almost see it almost more like Simon and Garfunkel. Like one of them goes a little bit further in his career than the other. You know? So
hey, our Garfunkel still has a blog. Maybe so does Casala somewhere.
So we're gonna have some fun with these stories, but it does also point to an important historical lesson, which was that religious sects were very much in competition for followers at the time, and they were not necessarily above fudging or fabricating their texts to use them as ammunition against their rivals. And we can see this, I don't mean to pick on the Jains at all, because we're going to be quoting mostly from a Jain text, but we can see it in Buddhism too. There's a Buddhist text from the Anguttara Nikaya, which does something similar, wherein the Buddha is purported to have said of Makale Gosala, the leader of the Ajivika, to have said of his teachings, "Just as a hair blanket is the worst of all fabrics in texture, appearance, and utility, so of all unorthodox doctrines, that of Makale is the worst."
Buddha dropped a sick
word. It's a good burn.
He's not mincing words. Now, the really interesting part about this little snippet here is that scholars think this might not have actually originally been aimed at Makale. It might have been originally aimed at a totally different guy named Ajita Kesakambali, who's not an Ajivika at all. He's associated with a totally different tradition.
So what I'm hearing is there's a lot of sects going on.
They think that because of the mention of the hair blanket, Ajita Kesakambali's kind of sort of signature is wearing this kind of hair, like I think it was a garment made of human hair. It was kind of an ascetic practice. Yeah. It'd be really kind of scratchy and uncomfortable to wear. And the scholar Basham theorizes that Gosala's name was inserted in Ajita's place later to provide more ammunition against the Ajivika, which suggests that the Ajivika as a religion might have actually been doing pretty good at the time, because if they felt the need to like add more ammunition against them
to amend it after the fact,
they were probably posing some real competition. So this kind of stuff went on back then, and not just in India, it happened in all. Check out religious history. It's not all gumdrops and unicorns. This happens a lot.
Yeah.
Next on Dead Ideas, the gumdrops and unicorn lollipops religion.
And it's bitter splintering after lemon drops into the picture.
Yeah.
Declared unorthodox.
Yeah. So at the same time that we enjoy some of the sheer, shall we say, goofiness of some of these stories, they also kind of make you wonder what it would be like if you actually had the story from the Ajivika, their version, the way they would have told it. So we can only speculate. So just to give just a brief little context, this was all described in detail last time, but just to recap for those who might have missed our last episode, the Ajivika was a religion from 5th century BCE India. It was largely an ascetic religion, they believed that you went through this round of incarnations, and it was fixed. There was nothing you could do to speed up or slow down your progress. Many of the other sects, like Buddhism and Jainism at the time, thought that by behaving in a moral way, a good way, you could get good karma and make progress toward liberation, and vice versa, behaving bad would get you bad karma and a worse incarnation and, you know, slow down your progress toward liberation. But the Ajivika thought, nope, that's not the deal. It's just fixed. Right, and they believed in a round of 8,400,000 incarnations where you experience the world as basically everything from an elephant to a dewdrop. And the last 7 incarnations are as a human, and the last human one involves 7 changes of body or reanimations where you die a natural death, yourself goes into somebody else's dead body, and you kind of squat in it like an abandoned office building, and you do that 7 times, and when you're all done, you die again, then you're done. Then just like a ball of string unwinding until the end, you're done. You achieve liberation. However they imagined liberation being. I don't know. They just thought you just blinked out of existence, or you rejoined the cosmos, or if it was kind of a blissful state. We have no information on that. It could have been any one of those things. Yeah, so that is basically, in a nutshell, the Ajivika religion.
Or what we know of it.
What we know of it, which, in you know, and we're not experts here in any way, shape, or form. We're just exploring history and having a fun time. So don't quote us in your senior thesis, okay? All right.
Quote us in your senior thesis.
So let's get into the stories, okay? So we're talking about two guys who were ascetics, right? Gosala and Mahavira. And a little bit about these ascetics. They practiced very severe austerities, such as taking a vow of poverty. Nonviolence was a big thing, not injuring any other form of life. And in some cases, probably in the Jain and Buddhist cases, that kind of had a moral tinge. In the Ajivika case, it may not have. It might have been more a means of gaining magical power, as we explored last time. But it's hard to tell. It's a little hard to tell. There is an interesting quote from the Rig Veda, which is a very ancient text that came long before even the Ajivika, but which may be describing this ascetic tradition that they're carrying on. It talks about something called a Muni, which may be a similar sort of figure. It says, "He with the long, loose locks," meaning locks of hair, "supports Agni," the fire god, "and moisture, heaven, and earth. He is all sky to look upon. He with long hair is called this light. The Munis, girdled with the wind, wear garments of soil hue. They, following the wind's swift course, go where the gods have gone before." So these ascetics were, they had taken a vow of poverty, which extended even to clothing as possessions. So they're mostly naked, maybe with a loincloth, probably a staff, and that's just about it. Probably long hair, and it said, or garments of soil hue. So if you did have clothes, kind of something kind of earth-toned and possibly maybe soiled because of, you're wandering around and it gets dusty.
Native hair.
Could be. Well, that was Ajita, really. So that,
the worst of all fabrics.
The worst of all fabrics, yes. Yes, and they took these great vows as part of their ascetic restrictions. Probably all the ascetics at the time that we're now talking about, that Gosala and Mahavira were in, had at least 4. The Jain religion has 5, one of which was added by Mahavira. So projecting back is probably something similar. The 4 vows were, one was ahimsa or nonviolence. One is tell the truth. Another is don't steal. And the last one is poverty or renunciation of worldly things. And then the 5th one that Mahavira apparently added was celibacy in action, word, and thought. Ascetic practices could be taken into a quite radical extent. In some cases, you were fasting sometimes even to the point of death. I mean, that was part of it for them. I mean, it was a different mindset back then. So we just kind of have to, take that as what it would have been for them. Okay, so also an important point about these ascetics is that their means of livelihood, since they were kind of wandering around the forests of North India and outside of the householder structure, outside of the normal social structures, they lived off of donations of others, so begging. And they kind of earned this. My interpretation is they earned the right to beg for food by these ascetics, which demonstrated their holiness. Mm-hmm. So I don't get the impression that it's just like, just anybody who is homeless could go around and just be like, yeah, give me food too. I think it was specifically associated with a holy way of life.
Just something that would be really hard to, you know, fake if you've been doing it for a while. It's like, yeah, that guy checks out.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you can't fake it. I mean, that's one, maybe that's one reason, kind of behind the ascetic practices. Like, it's very difficult to fake your commitment to a religious idea if you're doing something that extreme. So it's a signal to other people that you're sincere in your way of life.
This guy's got matted hair, he can count his ribs, he's asking you to put hot stew in his folded hands.
Yeah.
It's probably legit.
Yeah. Okay, so that's mendicants, that's these ascetics. And then, okay, Makale Gosala, or just Gosala, is the guy that we're focusing on here, the founder of the Ajivika religion. His dad was a mendicant or manka, one kind of these ascetics.
Obviously, one from the vow of celibacy hadn't taken effect with yet.
Yeah, and it seems, as far as I can tell from the way that scholars interpret it, maybe Gosala wasn't cool with the celibacy thing. That might have been a point of difference and division between him and Mahavira. But anyway.
Well, if you're stating that fate is fixed, I mean, you know, it's not really like abstention gets you much of anything, does it?
Unless it gets you magical power.
Well, good point. Yes. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Good point.
So anyway, his dad was a mendicant who made a living carrying around a holy picture and begging and reading omens and performing magic. And Gosala supposedly followed him in this mendicant occupation. And at some point, he saw this Mahavira guy and saw that he was doing these ascetics and was very respected and decided he wanted to join him. He was rejected at first, but eventually accepted. And one of the scholars that I read, I think it was Hornley, speculates that he and Mahavira may have bonded over the issue of attire. How much attire you were allowed in your vow of poverty. Mendicants at the time had three classes of them based on their dress. One was the class called the one-strip men, which means you kind of have a wrapper made of like one piece of cloth. So that was one kind. The other wore a pubic cover, which I imagine is basically just a fig leaf kind of idea.
That's a great phrase.
That's what it was in the text that I read, the scholars. And the last one was just complete nakedness. And Gosala was of the complete nakedness persuasion. And it seems that it's possible that Mahavira may have thought, oh yeah, he's really strict in his ascetic vows, and that's the way to go, and so I should check out this guy, maybe we should hang out. It's possible. So it could be that was the case. Now, the first story that I want to tell, this one actually doesn't come from the Jain text. This comes from a Buddhist commentary to the Samanaphala Sutta. This is by Buddhaghosa, writing long after. And this is totally, it definitely did not happen, right? There's really no question. This is a just-so story, okay? But this is what Buddhaghosa said, how Buddhaghosa says that Gosala adopted the nakedness idea, right?
This is going to be good.
So, this is a quote. Okay. So, Gosala was a slave. I don't know why he's calling him a slave, because we just heard that he was the son of a mendicant, but in Buddhaghosa's version, he was a slave. Gosala was a slave who, while walking over a patch of muddy ground, carrying a pot of oil, was hailed by his master with the words, "Don't stumble, old fellow!" But despite the warning, he carelessly tripped and spilt the oil. Fearing his master's anger, he made off, but his master pursued and overtook him, catching him by the edge of his robe. Leaving his garment behind him, Gosala escaped in a state of nudity. Hence, he became a naked mendicant. Ta-da!
I love how British the translation makes it sound. Don't stumble, old fellow!
I say or be!
Exactly.
What's that then, is nakedness?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was about to ask if slave was like some sort of a mistranslation, but it does sound like in this context.
I don't know. I'm not enough of a linguist to have any idea.
Contextually, it seems.
If he had a master, just as his beliefs were the hair shirts of beliefs, his personal background was...
totally abased. Plus, he can't carry stuff.
Yeah. So my suspicion is that the actual historical background between this nakedness issue is really how far to take the vow of poverty. That's what I'm getting from this. The idea that even a loincloth is considered a possession, therefore shouldn't be used. Not even a pubic cover. Right. Yeah, but you gotta love that image of him just like running off into the hills. You can hear the cartoon sounds.
Yes.
If he's covered in oil and mud, he's probably slipping away pretty easily.
This is true.
He could have been oily. Oh, it's getting worse by the minute.
Sorry.
Sorry anybody who considers this their cultural tradition. Yeah, we are doing a travesty here. So it seems that historically Mahavira actually permitted his followers the wrapper, but himself went naked. And like we said, possibly like got this idea from Gosala or bonded with Gosala over having the same idea. I'm not really sure.
Wow, you're naked?
I'm naked.
Yeah, we should hang out.
I guess we are hanging out, but I mean, we should, you know.
Oh, God.
What?
Hang out.
Yes. Okay.
Which body are you on?
What?
Well, that part's coming.
Okay.
That's coming in the story.
Sorry, spoilers.
Yeah, spoiler alert. So Gosala and Mahavira they're hanging out. They're wandering around North India now, naked, free and easy, letting it all hang out. And we get all these stories that are basically the adventures of these guys. So like I said, I'm going to be quoting from the scholar Basham, which you can check out. And like he said, he's portrayed
can I
as
quote
kind
of, him in their senior thesis.
You can ask Basham if you want that. Yeah,
give him the citations. Otherwise, he'll totally get angry.
So here, Gosala, like I said, he's kind of portrayed as the comic relief. So take this all with a hefty grain of salt. So the first story I want to tell is the example of how Gosala acquired his magical power.
Ooh.
Okay, and you can compare this to the Enlightenment story of other great founders of religions, like the Buddha or Mahavira or whatever. You can imagine that maybe if the Ajivika had stuck around, or we have their version of the story, it would have been some edifying Enlightenment story. But instead, we have this story that comes through this Jain text, where it's just how he gets his magical powers. So let's have a look. Okay, so starts with Gosala and Mahavira encountering an ascetic by the name of Vesiyayana, who is seated on the ground, facing the sun with his arms raised above his head, and he's engaged in a series of 3-day fasts. And they see when they get closer that his body is covered in insects. And this seems to be probably part of his vow of nonviolence. Like, he won't even interfere with the insects crawling all over him. So Basham tells what happens next. So he says, Gosala approached him and derisively asked him, "Sir, are you a Muni or a host for lice?" You can see him elbowing Mahavira there. But
Muni, the term from the Rigveda before, yes?
Yes, exactly. So the term for the ascetic, yeah, it's coming through here. So Vesayayana did not reply, and Gosala twice repeated the same question. After the third insult, Vesayayana's wrath was thoroughly aroused. In order to encompass Gosala's destruction, he stepped back 7 or 8 paces and released against him the magical heat which he had accumulated by his asceticism. So so he kind of like hauls back, like plants 1 foot and does like a total fireball. So, and there's something about this too. This seems to be the way it comes through in these texts. Like, even though you could imagine, and probably the way we imagine it because of movies and stuff, is like actual like burning fire, like flaming from your hands or something, like an anime style.
Yeah,
or something.
Heavy Dragon Ball Z vibes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's like total Dragon Ball Z or Naruto moment going on here. But it seems in this text that it's actually invisible to the naked eye because it seems possible to misunderstand what's going on.
Sure.
To sometimes come out in these texts. So yeah, it might be kind of like going on a psychic level here. Yeah. Maybe a microwave, sure. Of course. Yeah. Okay. So he hauls back and releases this magical heat on him, right? Okay. And then Bhasham continues, but Mahavira, taking pity on his companion, Gosala, mm-hmm. Counteracted the attack by releasing a flow of cooling magical power. So now you've got like the classic like duel of wizards, yeah. Right? With like a red stream of energy going against a blue stream of energy or something. I don't know. Right?
It sounds so much like a jingle from a commercial too. Now it's cooling magical power.
Cooling magical powers.
Yeah. Mahavira Bregnance.
Okay. Bhasham continues. When Visayana saw that Gosala was in no way injured by his attack, he was pacified and recognized Mahavira's superior psychic power. So remember, it's a Jain text. So Mahavira comes out looking like the really awesome guy here, and he gets this other guy to sort of bow to him. All right.
It does sort of point out that the linchpin of a lot of Indian religion is if you mess with ascetics, you're going to get messed up yourself.
Yeah?
Like, Rakshasa never learned, so. Yeah.
Well, yeah, Gosala apparently didn't learn that lesson. Okay, so after Mahavira had explained to Gosala what had happened, so that's where what makes me think like it's not obvious to the naked eye, the latter, Gosala, filled with terror and awe at his colleague's miracle, did him homage and asked him how he might too obtain similar powers. Mahavira replied that such powers could only be obtained after a 6 months course of strict penance.
You know, just for shaking up the routine, you know. I mean, we're ascetics, but, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, so it's even stricter. Yeah, but what I love about this, 6 months.
Yeah.
Only 6 months, and you get a fireball power?
Yeah, it's like, or cooling
it's like
power.
Two
magical
summer
cooling
camps.
Power. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, is that a course overload or what?
Yeah, yeah. 6 months, that's like, okay, two semesters, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet deal, really.
You finish being a freshman, and you can fireball a dude.
Well, you can counter fireball.
Yeah. Maybe that's where you have to go to grad school for counter fireballing, yeah.
Man, one more reason.
Or at least naked to sophomore.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how Gosala gets his magical powers. You can see in this, compared to like an Enlightenment story, like it kind of, Gosala comes off, first of all, like he can't defend himself, first of all. But secondly, like his motives are kind of suspect, right?
Yeah, it's like, I want to learn how to throw fireballs.
Yeah, it's just I want power is basically all his whole entire motive here. So I wonder if we got the Amjivika version, if there would have been some other kind of more high-minded motives, or if this really is what Amjivika was really after. We can only speculate. So
it is kind of interesting in light of what you said that maybe all the austerities that were practiced by the Amjivika might have been, again, to obtain magical powers. So it's sort of, I mean, that was your speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why were they doing all this if they believed that the outcome was going to be good? And, you know, it's kind of interesting if you view it like that.
Yeah.
Like these guys just wanted to be wizards.
It could be.
I mean, I'm not saying that's what it is, but it's sort of interesting.
I wish we knew.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next story that I want to share is about the Sasamum Bush. And we kind of gave this last time in a nutshell. This is about the story about the Sasamum Bush, and also this is the breakup of the bros here.
Aww.
Yeah, so this is how Gosala and Mahavira supposedly kind of go their separate ways, where they start to, there's just be a fracture in their friendship here. And it's also going to be how Gosala supposedly came up with the idea of reanimated corpses in the first place. So in this story, Gosala and Mahavira are wandering some more, and they come upon a sesamum shrub, which I imagine is, you know, the kind of plant that you get sesame seeds from. A sesamum shrub in full bloom. And Gosala gets the idea to test Mahavira's psychic powers of telling the future. So he asks him, will this sesamum bush bear fruit or not? And what will become of these 7 sesamum flowers?
7 again.
Yes. You see these numerology numbers coming up a lot. Yeah, that's right. So basically, Gosala's got the idea that he's kind of going to, you know, maybe expose Mahavira for not being all that. He's going to try and catch him in making a mistake in his prophesying here.
Fireballs are one thing. But,
yeah, oh yeah.
But telling
like,
the future.
You totally got your fireball, I get it. But telling the future, that's like junior level now.
Yeah.
Okay. So, he says, what will become of this sesamum bush and its seven sesamum flowers? Mahavira replied that the shrub would develop and that the seven sesamum flowers would produce seven seed pods in one cluster. Now, this very definite answer displeased Gosala, and he determined to prove Mahavira a liar.
Is this an allegory for future sex of Jainism? It sounds suspiciously like an allegory for the history of future sex of Jainism.
I don't know.
Are there seven?
I don't know. So he quietly dropped behind. Gosala dropped behind Mahavira. So he's kind of like pulling a, you know, like a kind of a secret move here. And he pulled up the sesamum bush. But, and I gather that this was unbeknownst to Gosala even now, but at that moment a shower of rain fell and the plant took root again, and so the flowers ripened and seven sesamum pods were produced in one cluster, just as Mahavira had prophesied. But like I said, it seems like they had moved on. Gosala doesn't really know this.
Right.
Okay. So, soon afterwards, the couple returned by the same road. As they drew near the spot where the sesamum plant grew, Gosala reminded Mahavira of his forecast and declared that he would find that the plant had not ripened and the seeds had not formed. Mahavira, on the other hand, stood firm by his prophecy. He declared that he had been aware all the time of what Gosala had done.
Because of your chortling.
The plant had been pulled up and had temporarily died, but it had been reanimated by the shower and was once more living, while the seven pods had developed in the cluster. This is what Mahavira is telling to Gosala. Plants, Mahavira added, were capable of, and I'm going to mangle this pronunciation, but pauta parihara, or reanimation without transmigration. But Gosala still would not believe Mahavira's word. But on approaching the actual sesamum cluster, he found that it contained the seven seed pods just as Mahavira had prophesied. The revival of the sesamum plant made such an impression upon him that he became convinced that all living beings were likewise capable of reanimation. And so first of all, okay, so his mind is blown by this, clearly. He's like, yes. Whoa! Right. Yeah, you're right. And plants can reanimate? Whoa! Right, so but then he starts to take just a little bit too far. You can start to see Mahavira going like, dude, hold up.
No, that's not what I said, man. I said roots are a thing.
Yeah, it is.
Hold me right here. Plants. Yes. I said plants, right? But Mahavira is like, he's already like concocting whole other ideas here. Like, maybe I can do this. Maybe everybody can do this.
You don't have roots, bro.
Yeah. And then, so this is kind of becoming like, they're developing different ideas. And I love how Basham summarizes the end of this. He just does it in one sentence and says, and on this point, he and Mahavira parted company and their association came to an end.
So is it orthodox or heretical to ship them?
To do what?
Oh, no. I mean, I know everybody else does historical religious figure / fan fiction, but still.
Oh, no. We're going to do fanfic of Gosala and Mahavira?
No.
I think we're really going to get in trouble now.
No,
okay, this is obviously the end of Dead Ideas. Yeah. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Sorry, guys. Well, on the other hand, it would be gross before horror to culture.
Yeah, maybe.
That was strange. That was worse. I'm sorry.
It does make me wonder, though, if sesamum bushes actually behave like century plants. Would they can easily root themselves in a rainfall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, or like spider plants or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe soil is just really good and muddy and it just, you just took great root.
Yeah, I don't know. So, you know, I can see it as this reanimation of plants as being like maybe a legitimate way that they thought about plants. Because you see plants all the time kind of like, you know, turning brown to the point where they certainly look dead. Well,
there are plants that can literally do that, that can roll away and be blown hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, the resurrection plant.
Yeah, resurrection plant. That was what I was trying to think about last century.
Yeah, so you know, it could have definitely been like a pretty much a naturalistic scientific idea of the time. You know?
Of course, it is a flowering shrub, so...
Yeah, well, you know, the fact of it being a sesame plant may have been added later for some symbolic reference that we can't decipher. Who knows?
It's delicious.
I am still smelling allegory.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's definitely at least a just-so story, if not an allegory of some kind.
How many sects are there within Jainism? I mean, I'm assuming, are there any splinters?
Today?
Yeah.
As far as I know, and I'm by far not an expert at all, but as far as I know, there's at least two main sects. Huh. And the biggest difference, I think, is on how much clothing that their lead ascetics wear.
Really?
Like, there's one, I think the biggest sect starts with an S. I don't want to attempt it because I don't have it written down here, but they wear clothes, and then the Digambra don't. So, I don't know.
So they weren't actually prevented from having sex.
Prevented from...
Yeah. Are you doing a pun?
S-E-C-T-S here, guys. Come on. Heads out of the gutter.
Yeah, let's go back to talking about all the compulsory nudity. Jeez.
Okay. So, no, seriously. So I think in this Just So story, what it's probably really pointing to, I'm guessing, is a developing rivalry between... two kind of factions in the ascetic movement. Two factions that may then develop into the Angivika and on the one hand, and the Jains on the other. And this text is probably being, you know, fudged or fabricated in order to make the other sect look the best. Right.
Yes.
So. Okay.
Again, like early Christian heresies.
Yeah, definitely.
You won't believe what these guys did.
For our next tale. So Mahavira is already starting to think that this Gosala guy is, like, he's getting a little out there, right? He's starting to kind of, like, develop some ideas that are a little strange and kind of a little off his rocker. So they split up and stuff, right? The next tale is about their magical duel.
Yes!
Wait, there are two magical duels? You didn't tell us about that.
Yeah.
Oh, so the first one was, I guess you could call it a duel, but it was just between the...
Right.
This is the showdown.
Okay.
Between Mahavira and Gosala. Yes. Ooh. They have a magical duel. Okay. So this is definitely like the, you know, we're getting towards the climax of the movie here. In another story, after 16 years of kind of wandering separately now, and by this time they've kind of picked up followers of their own within the text of this story.
Starting to sound like a Chinese kung fu movie.
Oh, yeah. So, they kind of meet up again, and Mahavira is revolted to hear of the way that Gosala has been living. It doesn't exactly clearly say this in the summaries I get from the scholars, but I get the impression that he's probably, like, sees him as having broken his vows. Mm-hmm. Like, definitely he thinks he's not being a real Shramana or a real ascetic. He's, you know, he's not the real thing anymore. And, like, there's a bunch of different things that he's accused of, but among other things, and this is the one that seems to be almost kind of like a sticking point here, is Gosala is accused of living on the property of a potter woman. Oh, scandal. Living on the property of a woman. Mm. Yes. So I'm guessing that the implication is that he's, you know, maybe getting something on the side. Or the author of this text is trying to put that thought in your head without just coming out and saying it directly.
So he's living with a pot dealer. Sorry.
Yes, potter woman.
Which in the history of ancient Indian religion probably would be not scandalous at all.
Yeah, probably not. I don't think it's too scandalous today.
No,
I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah. But apparently living on the property of a potter woman is for an ascetic. At least in Mahavira's view. So Mahavira starts telling his followers about Gosala. He's like dishing out all the dirt now from the times when they were adventuring together. He's like, get a load of this, guys. This time, like, we're like, we saw this guy covered in insects. Guess what this guy did, right?
Got his ass microwaved. That's what happened.
Yeah. Okay, so he's totally talking about him behind his back. And Gosala, of course, gets wind of this, that Mahavira has been talking about him, and he's furious. So, you know, at this point, you know, shit's going down. Right?
Mahavira, love ancient hermit drama.
Yeah, it's getting dramatic here, yeah.
Oh, no,
So now there's this scene where they both show up. And you gotta admit, they got followers. They both show up with, like, their whole posse.
With posses, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So you gotta imagine this, like rival gangs almost kind of showing up. But they're, like, rival ascetic gangs, right? So, like, they're totally giving each other this kind of, like, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, glare from across the way, you know. But they're also, you know, wearing their loincloths or nothing at all. And, you know, you can see their ribs and they're kind of, like, half-starved and stuff. So, yeah. So we've got this showdown. Here, of the rival sex.
This is really a kung fu movie, isn't
it? Yeah. And Mahavira accuses Gosala, publicly now, in front of all the followers, of not, you know, being a real ascetic. And, you know, the subtext, I think, is that the vows that he made back when he and Mahavira knew each other earlier, like he has basically gone back on them, has broken mm-hmm. those vows. And then Gosala comes up with the most genius defense. And this is smooth. This is like Bill Clinton level smooth. Oh, this is like I did not inhale kind of stuff here. So Gosala says, he goes back to that reanimation idea that he got from the plant, the Sesamum plant. And he says, basically, I'm paraphrasing now, he says, I'm not the Gosala that you knew previously. That Gosala is dead. I'm actually an entirely different person reanimating the dead corpse of the guy that you knew.
Ooh.
So, therefore, it was not me that made those vows. Therefore, I did not break them.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So, Shades of Heraclitus, you can't reanimate the same corpse twice.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Wow.
Or the same corpse can't be... I don't know, it gets deep.
Yeah. So that's the defense that he gives, right?
All perfect.
And then Mahavira, hearing this, does a total, like, psh. He's like, what? No. You know, he's not buying this. He's totally not gonna let this, you know, stand.
So he starts asking the questions that only he would know.
Yeah. I wish he did, right? Yeah. I wish he did. So he says that Gosala is like a thief chased by villagers, feverishly trying to hide himself. And then he says to Gosala, it won't do, Gosala. That shadow is your own and nobody else's. And then you can almost, you basically see him holding the L up on his forehead here. He's just kind of like, nah, it's not happening. So of course this makes Gosala furious, right? And he curses Mahavira. Then one of Mahavira's followers stands up for him, and this is from Pashao now, Gosala promptly turned his anger upon the faithful disciple and immediately reduced him to a heap of ashes by the magic force which he had accumulated from his asceticism.
So he did well in those 6 months.
Yeah, passed freshman fireballing. Yeah, he's totally got it. Yeah, so he unleashes his fireball and reduces this follower to ashes. Then another disciple stands up for him and gets incinerated as well. Then it's finally time for the climactic battle, the showdown between actual Gosala and Mahavira. So we got the boss battle now. This is their magical duel. Okay. Gosala once more turned to Mahavira and repeated his curses. The latter reproached him in terms the same as those used by his two dead disciples. Gosala then stepped back and attempted to destroy his adversary by his magic power. But on so perfect an ascetic as Mahavira, the magic was quite ineffectual. The stream of supernatural force rebounded and penetrated the body from which it had emanated. So basically, Mahavira was like, you know, I'm rubber, you're glue.
Yeah.
It just made his Gosala's curse kind of like reflect back on Gosala and affect him.
Oh, he can deflect force lightning.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, he's got deflection power. But apparently Gosala was unaware of what had happened. Huh? As he says, "You are now pervaded by my magic force," he says to Mahavira, "and within 6 months you will die of bilious fever." And I looked up what this was, and it's kind of like any kind of fever that involves like a high temperature and diarrhea and I think one other thing, I forget what. So just nastiness, apparently. Mm-hmm. Right? So he's cursing him to diarrhea, basically, to die of it. So not the most noble way to go out.
Mm.
But, Basham continues, unperturbed, Mahavira replied that the magic power of Gosala had had no effect on him, but that...
I love your sassy head. Yes. I wish we could get the sassy head back into the microphone.
But yeah, let the record straight that state that Brandon is sashaying and no effect.
Right. Yeah. Had no effect on him, but that Gosala himself would die of bilious fever within 7 nights, smitten by his own power.
Seven again.
Mm-hmm. He, Mahavira, on the other hand, would live on Earth as a Jinna, which I believe is a form of enlightened being, for another 16 years.
Again, 16?
Yes. So that's the magical duel. But this gets their followers riled up, of course. And in one of the scholars that I read, he interpreted it as the followers actually come to blows over this, like physical violence.
None of them has passed fireball training.
None of them's good at this vow of renunciation of violence either. Anybody failed that one.
Well, I don't know if he's correct in this, but that's what this one is saying. So you got this picture of like a total monk riot here, basically, and you got to wonder what that would have looked like in their half starved ascetic bodies and their loincloths or naked, just trying to beat each other up and stuff.
Pro tip for the reader: you can find this between Orthodox and Catholic monks in Jerusalem on YouTube.
Yes. Oh my God.
Parallels.
They're slightly more close, but they're still hitting each other with brooms.
Yes. History repeats itself. What's the phrase? History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Something like that. Okay, so that is the climactic battle, the magical duel. The end of the story now is the fever and death of Gosala. So the last little bit of our tale here. Gosala purportedly actually does die of a fever, but remember this is coming from a Jain text, so I don't know. So of course Mahavira's magic would have worked. But anyway, he dies of a fever, and before he dies, though, he actually goes rather delirious from it and does some rather unascetic-like things, such as drinking, singing, dancing, yes, splashing himself with muddy water from the potter's wheel.
Well, I mean, that just seems like good practice. It gets the heat off.
Well, you would think.
It works for hippos.
And holding a mango in his hand.
Well, that is pretty obscene.
It is.
Yeah, and it's really up to speculation of what the reference is here. I think there was one scholar that speculated that maybe he was actually holding the mango stone, like the seed from inside it, indicating that he ate the mango, the fruit of it, and therefore broke like some kind of fast. But who knows?
I don't want to judge. I've held some mangoes in my hand.
Right. You've done some mangoes. We've all been there. We all went to college, right?
Speak for yourself. What have you been holding mangoes?
Yeah, we've all experimented with the mango holding.
Oh my God. I'm totally cursing you guys and taking my followers.
Okay. So, and these eccentric acts.
I know you are, but what am I?
Ooh.
Ooh.
Oh God, why am I holding a mango?
Did you just rebound her burn on you?
Oh,
yeah. You're learning something from this. Okay, so these eccentric acts are given as the just so story for probably the origin of another Ajivika doctrine called the four potables and the four impotables.
Ah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the funny part is that these are already kind of pretty bizarre on their own without already giving a weird derivation of it. At least it seems so from our perspective. So the four potables are the things which may be drunk by an Ajivika ascetic. And they include, first, cow urine. Because why not? Right? Second, muddy water from a potter's vessel. You can see the reference in the story there.
I'm guessing if it's basic, it might settle your stomach.
Maybe. God. Kind of like a Pepto kind of idea. Third, what is heated by the sun? I'm not sure.
Okay, that applies to most things.
Mm-hmm. And last, what drips from a rock? Which may have been a reference to that mango stone, or it could just be... You know, I don't know what it is. I don't know.
Is it really worth being a wizard?
I don't know. If you get fireballs, I'd have to say yes. okay. So, and then the four impotables, which are the things which may be touched but not drunk. And I had a hard time, actually getting this, because they're kind of summarized by all the different scholars that I read in a not quite clear way. This is the clearest that I got. So the four impotables are water jars, mangoes, beans, and then the scholar that gave me this, the fourth one, he says, etc. It's like, whoa. Come on, there was only one more.
All those things that are like mango jar, mangoes, water jars, and beans. And seriously, what is it with ascetic traditions and beans?
Yeah, I know.
That's always a thing.
Right, because what am I thinking of?
The Pythagoreans could be beans.
Yes, the Pythagoreans weren't supposed to eat beans.
Yeah.
And all the Roman traditions of having the festival where you threw beans over your shoulder at ghosts.
I don't know.
Did
maybe
the Japanese do that too, or is that rice? Or is it beans?
Rice and beans.
The question really would be, what would have been the grain or legume that they would have had at the time. So anyway,
A little and embryonic.
That may have been the Ajivika doctrine that was alluded by that delirium story. So anyway, just before his death, Gosala apparently, according to this text, the Jain text, comes out of his delirium and realizes how scandalously he's been behaving. And he has basically his come to Jesus moment. And he says, oh, man, I've been a total fraud. I'm not really a Juna, an enlightened being. And he says, Mahavira is the real thing. And he instructs his followers to do away with his body in a most dishonorable way. He says, and Basham is explaining here, they were to tie a rope to his left foot, to spit thrice into his face, and to drag his body round the streets of Savati, one of the cities, proclaiming that he was not a Jinna, but a cheat and a murderer, and that Mahavira was the only true Jinna.
See, this doesn't feel like it's, feeding a line at all.
No. This is definitely not, ammunition here. After this, they were to dispose of his body without respect.
Although, incidentally, that was kind of common tradition if you're an Orthodox monk as well, that you would ask to be dragged through the streets without...
Yeah.
And sort of spit upon and then just dump somewhere.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Why?
Interesting.
I mean, presumably you haven't founded any heretical sects or anything, have you? Is it just...
It's to make sure... It's as a sign of humility to make sure no one thinks you're a saint and references your remains as relics afterwards.
Yeah,
you're proving that you don't think you're that.
Yeah, that's interesting. There could be a connection there, or it could be just this similar ideas give rise to similar practices.
I wasn't so much mentioning as a connection as
weird. Yeah.
And there's a precedent for people asking that deliberately of themselves as a form of humility, not as a.
I was wrong.
Right.
I'm so wrong.
Yeah.
Did anybody who had that dent to them actually go on to become a saint anyway?
Everyone the story's told about, because otherwise why would they bother to tell the story?
it never worked. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it didn't work in this case either.
Right.
So, even in the Jain text, it says, okay, so Mahavira asked for this treatment by his followers, but after his death, his followers just made a pretense of obeying the letter of his instructions. They kind of drug him around a room or something, but not publicly, so something like that. And then actually had a great lavish funeral for him with great respect. And, you know, that's how Gosala went out. Yeah. And I have to wonder, this is my wild speculation, everybody, but I have to wonder if maybe the actual memory of Gosala's real death was still alive enough at the time that he couldn't get away with totally rewriting it and had to at least put that part in, but was able to rewrite something before it.
Yeah, because this is a pretty close to contemporary text within a few centuries.
Within a few centuries. Yeah. Although, you know, we see from religious history and all kinds of different traditions that a few centuries can make a pretty big difference.
Well, yeah.
Sure, but it's a lot closer than James telling stories about the person who lived 84,000 years ago, for example.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that's the last story that we got for you today. So we're going to close out this, but I think we should go out on a good note, right? On a bang. And so let's just have a few mentions at the end about the legacy of the Ajibika, because this tradition is a completely unsung tradition, basically, right? Like, who remembers the Ajibika? Almost nobody, right?
Except the people who are irritated with
it. Exactly. You remember how irritating they were way back when. You remember that guy at the party?
Oh, God. Yeah.
You remember that guy? Oh, man.
I was always casting, like, a cool dissipating wave because he was always
getting
into
fights. I totally shielded him. Yeah, yeah.
Although, I've got to say, I'm picturing the moment now when future fans of the podcast start flooding us with requests for Team Ajivika or Team Mahavira t-shirts.
Oh, no!
God,
yeah, and,
let's
not
get letters.
Oh, man. Oh, I hope we don't start like a fan following now. Like the rebirth of something here. Oh, boy. Yeah.
The rebirth or the reanimation?
The reanimation. Okay.
Like, all this, I was into Ajivika before it was cool. Like, literally.
Yeah. You heard it first, folks. Yep, us three. Yep, mm-hmm. we were into it before. It was cool.
I've got two mangoes, one in each hand. I'm feeling building.
I'm totally feeling. I'm holding that mango. Okay, so the Ajibika religion started like 5th century BCE, as far as we can tell. Carries on, especially in South India, till about the 14th century CE. So that's about 2,000 years. Not quite. Pretty close. Pretty good run of it, right? It's about as long as Christianity has been around. It's not clear why it died out, maybe merged into other traditions, possibly some elements contributed to the Digambara Jain tradition, but, you know, I don't want to speculate too wildly there. Jains, you can say for yourself, you know, whether or not that's the case.
Random side note, that's somewhat longer than Buddhism had much of a following in the Indian subcontinent, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, why don't... Yeah,
I'm not
sure
exactly
when Buddhism died out in India. It did mostly die out in India and had to be reintroduced later. Buddhism's legacy was mostly carried on and developed in other countries of Asia and had to be reintroduced.
Yeah, the last things I know about are like 9th or 10th century, but...
Something like
that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, it seems, from what we can tell from the evidence, that Ajivika may have been... more popular than either Jainism or Buddhism for a while. And like you say, maybe even carried on longer in India itself. That's a good point. But a little bit about the legacy. So one thing that is notable, I guess, or at least we might consider it notable, is they contributed to the anti-caste system sentiment. Similar to how the Buddhists did. The Buddha also accepted people of all castes into their ranks. Apparently the Ajivika did as well. And it seems like maybe it was popular with the Shudra. Another thing probably contributed to the whole vegetarianism and nonviolence stream of development in Indian tradition. But interestingly, not for the motive of excoriating your bad karma, but perhaps for its own sake, or perhaps to get magical power. But
to do fireballs.
But to do fireballs.
Abstain from violence so that you can fry people.
But you know, to be serious though, I have to imagine that there was some lay followers too, a considerable lay following, and they're not going to be doing ascetic practices to gain magical powers. I mean, that's going to be your minority within the religion. And then the lay followers, you know, were they vegetarian and nonviolent? Not sure, maybe to some extent. But to them, it wouldn't be for the motive of magical powers So what would it be? Maybe just for itself. I mean, that maybe that's a feather in their cap. I don't
maybe
know.
They
speculation.
Just picked it up from the existing. I mean, assuming that there's any remainder of the Buddhist tradition like that, maybe it just sort of got incorporated as latent. You know, this is what you do.
No, yeah, that's possible.
The Jains were much, much more strict with their nonviolence than Buddhists.
Well,
yeah, I kind of get the tradition.
I think it was
competition.
I get the impression
the headers all
way less violent than you.
Yeah,
yeah,
we're so unviolent.
I feel like all three traditions were kind of drawing on something prior.
Yeah,
and yeah, carrying it on in their own ways. Another thing interesting is the theory of atomism. They were possibly the earliest in the world, or one of the earliest in the world, to theorize that nature is composed of indivisible units that are smaller than the naked eye can see. So we're not talking about like protons and neutrons exactly, but units that are indivisible and smaller than the naked eye can see. That's atomism. Between them and the Vaiseska tradition, associated with the sage Kanada, their view of nature was this atomistic idea. So that's an interesting connection and feather in their hat. Also, natural law, a resonance at least with modern kind of Western scientific views of nature. This idea that you can't do anything morally to sort of speed up or slow down your progress through the incarnations, it's fixed. The idea that the universe operates on a cosmic principle that's just the way it is rather than how you want it to be, you know, natural law, kind of like a little bit similar to that. And the embrace of fate also, of just sheerly embracing that no matter what, like you're going to go through these incarnations, you're going to reanimate 7 times into dead bodies, and their kind of slogan or catchphrase is usually translated as human effort is ineffectual, which sounds just kind of like basically shit happens, a pessimistic thing. But if you kind of look at parallels in other cultures, it can be ennobling. Like the samurai, for example, have a saying, the samurai from Japan have a saying that like, if it's raining, don't cringe because you're going to get wet anyway. So it's this kind of just like bold, disciplined, like, I'm going to live my life regardless of the consequences kind of thing, you know, even unto death, kind of noble embrace of, you know, the world and fate. And it's not necessarily a pessimistic idea either, because you can compare this idea of predestination to sort of Calvinism, the Calvinist doctrine that everything is predetermined by God. And whether you're going to hell has already been decided. It's not you really choosing. Correct me if I'm getting it wrong here, Nick, but...
You're making me want to write a long series of stories where Calvin and St. Augustine hang out. St. Augustine tells how Calvin gets everything wrong.
Fireballs. Total fireballs.
Yeah. And then there's like a rebounding of, yes. Oh, yeah. Excellent.
That would be the non-Protestant view of Calvin. He's the guy who fucks up St. Augustine.
This is going to be, listeners, this is like, if you're on the ins with us, you'll get this extra bonus material that nobody else can find. This. We're going to do this as our just-so story. No.
Let's see.
Maybe. Anyway, so Calvinism it's not really a pessimistic way of life. So you can imagine that maybe a Jivaka wasn't either. And you can also compare it a little bit to the Universalists in that, you know, everybody eventually kind of makes it to salvation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Wild, anachronistic comparisons, but you know, you can at least see it. It's a way to wrap your mind around it a little bit.
Fireballs.
Fireball. But fireballs. Yes, but fireballs.
But fireballs?
Well, speaking of the tradition of dying of diarrhea.
Yeah.
Sorry. Oh. God, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, explosive?
Oh,
that's a way to
end. And you're going to end on a high note.
I'm
thanks.
Oh,
I'm glad
man.
I contributed.
Oh, we had to go there. Okay, well, that's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. That's all for our second episode. Thank you to my co-hosts, Nick and Anna. Loved having you on the show. It was awesome.
It was great to be here.
It was.
Yeah. So So, listeners, if you like this, be sure to tell us, write in, email us, rate and review us on iTunes.
Apply for a 6-month fireball course.
Yes, yes. I believe maybe like Phoenix University, or it's one of those online courses. You could probably find it. I'm not
day,
sure.
One day, one night, 6 months.
You mean you're not offering?
I don't know. Phoenix University, please don't sue us.
Or send any kinds of fireballs after us.
We officially recant what we just said.
Yeah, tie something around our legs and drag us around the
Yes, corner. Yes, yes, yes. We are not enlightened at all.
We okay. hold all the mangoes.
Okay. And if you, listeners, if you know of a dead idea that you want us to explore, let us know. Write in. Okay, thanks everybody. And check us out next time. Have a great night.
Night.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening once again, everybody. To show support for Dead Ideas, please rate and review us on iTunes. No matter what platform you're listening on right now, stop. Go to iTunes right now and download all of our episodes and write a review. We don't care if you give us 1 star. We don't care if you say we sucked. Just give us a review. The more downloads and reviews we get, the higher iTunes ranks us. So be honest. And remember, once again, if you are one of the first 20 people to review us on iTunes, you get yourself drawn as a comic book character in the historical time period and culture of your choosing. Anna and I will draw you, and we will make you look awesome. You can be a Viking berserker, you can be a medieval troubadour, you can be an ancient Egyptian cat. Whatever you want, we'll draw you, and it'll be awesome, I promise. So just review us on iTunes and then email us a photo that we can work from at deadideaspod@gmail.com. Also visit us online at deadideas.net. Find us on social media at deadideaspod or email us at deadideaspod@gmail.com. Music and graphic design by Rachel Westhoff. Thanks for listening, everybody.